This is Paul Nobles from Eat to Perform, and I am sitting here with my trusty cohort, Becky. We have lost Carolyn in a weird baseball trade where we got like some baseball bats and lost Carolyn in the mix somehow. I'm kidding. She's doing a house remodel, and so she is not going to be able to do these calls. And so it's just going to be Becky and I. Two peas in a pod, just the way it was always meant to be. So Becky is the director of coaching here at Eat to Perform, and basically is my right-hand person. And so any questions that you have, Becky is probably the go-to for that. Kind of goes in. I feel like you've surpassed whatever I might have brought into the table. And then we have, of course, Susan Kleiner, if we have to really go through anything specific. I'll tell you guys actually sort of a funny story in that regard. Becky and I talk all the time. Susan and I talk, I would say, probably twice a month. And usually it's kind of bigger and broader topics, you know, so like, I don't think it's any secret that this new class of weight loss medication is sort of taking the diet world by the storm. Susan and I talked about that and kind of the potential ramifications of what it could mean and things of this nature, because Susan kind of has this background, you know, where weight loss medication has been around for a long period of time in various forms, but most of the forms that it's come in before, the side effects were worse than the advantage. And then ultimately people regain the weight anyway. I do think that that is the case, even in the case of this. So then you go, well, why would you take it, right? Well, I think that if you're doing things, as an example, in like the Eat to Perform way, and I'm only, excuse me for one second here. I'm only kind of mentioning this because this was the discussion that Susan and I were having, is that when you are a fit person and you have reached your weight loss goals, or you've decided, you know, like for instance, I've gotten as low as 150 pounds. That was really, really small for me. I did not have a lot of muscle at that time. I would say since that time, I've been able to put on about 20 pounds of muscle. So a comparable Paul would be around 170 pounds right now. Could I get to 170? Sure, right? That's possible. Do I want to? Maybe, maybe not. You know, I haven't had the urge in the last 11 to 12 years. Mostly because I just enjoy my life. I think one of the things that we were talking about, because Susan is really performance nutrition. I mean, she works with, you know, the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team and all this other type of stuff. These types of people aren't concerned about abs, right? They're concerned about athletic performance. And so in a way, that's really similar to all of us, right? You do have the decision to live a comfortable life where food is an ally in your journey, and your health is viewed as something that you're taking a proactive measure towards. I'm going to have to pause here for just a second, but I'll be right back. And we're back. Okay. And so when you have, you know, at my lowest, I was around 7 or 8%, right? And so it's kind of nice to see that, and your veins are popping out below your navel, and you know, I never really had like a 6 to 8 pack. I had kind of a pretty well-defined 4 pack, But what you start to realize at your leanest, which for me was a really light weight, is that those muscles needed to be developed, right? And so that was actually right about the time that Eat to Perform started to happen. And what happened in that moment is really kind of what we sort of teach all of you, is that you get to be able to choose your destiny, right? And so when we look at the cycles and whether you want to constantly, be in a diet cycle or not, I think that we're probably the only diet program out there that's sort of showing you that the diet cycle should be optional, right? It should be based on, living an energetic life. And I think honestly, a lot of people just get stuck. They start going down a path of being fit, and then they don't necessarily realize why you kind of lose sight of why you started the journey in the first place, right? And so, especially with the model of lose as much weight as much as possible. So in my mind, and one of the reasons why we want to be in this fight a little bit, we're actively trying to say to people that has taken this medication, you're much better off getting help, working with a coach so that you do it right. But not just that you do it right, but that you then walk away with better information, right? I think what's going on TikTok, is going to be real bad. Right. I think that what we're going to see in 2 to 3 years is all the people that are using this weight loss medication to eat less pizza are going to find that in that time, they did not build healthy habits. They did not build. We've actually been approached by people that want to partner with us to help their clients. But the reality is many of their clients don't want the help. Right. Because, if you're following the discussions that we're having with my friend, we've been talking a lot about her on the phone, and one of the things he talked about was that his wife brought home a bunch of Girl Scout cookies, and he's just started the medication this week, and he doesn't know if it's placebo or not. He's like, but I literally don't have any interest. He's like, if I did not have this medication, I would have definitely, and I was on a diet, I'm eating those cookies, right? And so you sort of lose, because basically what it does is it's your fat talking to your brain, right? And then it kind of shuts off the reward system, right? And so it does allow you to, frankly, the best way to say it is it makes dieting easier, right? Especially for people with a lot of weight to lose, right? Because one of the things that Becky and I see, and this was part of the discussion I was having with Susan, was that, when you're 65 pounds, when you're 300 pounds or 350 pounds, it will shock people to see that those people will actually stall. They might lose 30, 40 pounds relatively easy. And then all of a sudden, let's say it's a man and their calories get to 2000 and they just can't adhere to it, for a million different reasons. But mostly it's that fat talking to their brain going, yo, this needs to stop. We need food, right? And so if you're doing it wrong, you're going to become over-reliant on the medication. One of the things that I'm seeing advocates talk about, and this was sort of kind of the end point of Susan and I's conversation, but there's a lot of people, and there are some studies that support this right now, but that's the way science works, right? And so if you're not familiar with science, you have to get familiar with sometimes the information in the beginning isn't the big information in the end. And so if you're a diabetic and you're taking this for diabetes, you should probably listen to your doctor in that regard. But if you're pre-diabetic, you're trying to get weight under control, things of this nature, you do have more options than what those studies might suggest, right? And so using it cyclically, you can possibly lose more weight. So if you're 350 pounds, you know, the maximum for this medication is right around 15. It'll be 20 for outliers. You know, if you're, let's say, 300 pounds, yes, it's nice to get down to 240, but realistically, you probably want to be much less than that, right? So if you stay on the medication and you eat 800 to 1,000 calories, one, that's not going to give you kind of the nutrients that your body needs to sustain yourself over time. So now you've taken something that was a negative, right? And you've turned it into a positive. But the more you do that, you're going to be dealing with bone loss. You're going to be dealing with ligament loss. You know, one of the things that's been really interesting talking to my friend is that, you know, his energy level is gone, right? Now he's not hungry, right? But there's no energy. And so, you know, and I keep telling him, I'm like, look, you got to make sure that you're getting in some kind of weight training, because one of the things that people the studies definitely show this, that people that don't have exercise in their mix when they're using this type of stuff do lose a significant amount of muscle, which if you think about it, you know, the people that are having the most success are the people that weigh the most. They typically don't have good habits in place. They typically don't have a good workout routine. So they're just going to use it to lose as much weight as possible. And in a way, they're sort of cavalier about the muscle loss. But in another way, you know, like I was talking to a friend of mine that was a trainer, and he was like, yeah, but if you're 350 pounds and you lose 15 pounds of muscle, you probably needed to lose 15 pounds of muscle. And he's not wrong, right? Your body doesn't now need to have that much muscle to support your system because you're no longer, you know, that weight, right? So there is always going to be some muscle loss and things of this nature. I genuinely think that for the people that are obese, we know that almost half of the population is obese right now. This has the potential to be a godsend. I don't think it's going to be that for a lot of people, though. I think that they're not going to go through a program through Eat to Perform. They're not going to talk to a doctor like we're kind of setting up through Eat to Perform Health and things of that nature. And hopefully we can start to make some inroads in that way. But when you look at companies like a Weight Watchers or a, you know, some of the other companies out there that are starting to prescribe medication, what do we know? Well, we know that their North Star is people dieting all the time. And what we also know is that, you know, in the case of Weight Watchers, their business model, I'm not saying anything in a negative way, right? This is just fact. Right. But their business model is built around you dieting. Right. They've made some inroads to the other side of things, but it's more mindset and things of this nature. They're not teaching you, as an example, how to live in a non-dieting cycle like we do here at Eat to Perform. And so, you know, I thought 10 years ago that what we talked about in terms of like the cyclical nature of the way the diets need to work, I thought that that would become the norm literally 5 years down the road. And, you know, 7 years down the road, you know, there's probably 5% of the population out there just eating meat, right? So we went the wrong direction by far, right? The internet, you know, is something that can be used as a powerful tool for intelligence. But it is often a powerful tool for ignorance, and we fight that fight every single day. But the reality is that, you know, when people look at at these types of things, whether it be, you know, and I'm speaking more towards Eat-Perform Health now, but, you know, there's people that think that replacing testosterone is a shortcut, or taking weight loss medication is a shortcut. I think that is a very personal decision for a lot of people. But when we're talking about, you know, what I look at Eat-Perform Health is a proactive approach to, you know, what you want your life to become. I view it as an aging thing, right? I've always viewed Eat-Perform in this regard. And so when I looked at kind of like the one hole in my game, I was like, well, what is it that you're doing personally that you could bring to everyone else? And it was certainly, you know, hormone replacement. And so I think we still have to deal with some stigma related to shortcuts and things of this nature. But overall, you know, I think that the way that we're approaching Eat-Perform Health, and just so you know, I know many of you are not lifetime clients. We do have a lifetime push coming out. We have a lifetime bundle within that, so you can talk to the coaches and see if that's a good fit for you. But the reality is most of you do kind of want to know whether or not you're deficient. I can't tell you how many women I know that think that they have hormone problems, and they're probably right, but they don't know which hormone problem that they have. And they almost certainly don't know that hormones could be replaced. One of the things that's been interesting in doing all of this is finding out that in the UK, hormone replacement is covered by national medicine, which is really interesting, right? Because it really shows, I think recently I learned that in Brazil, plastic surgery is covered by national health. And so even other countries have very different views on health. And so I think it's really exciting that we have this. I think that hopefully we can kind of get past the stigma. The one thing that I definitely wanted to run through before we start to get into questions was this idea of, oh, I'm going to take my Eat-Perform Health information and the consultation that I got through that to my primary care physician, right? So totally, you can do that. I think your experience isn't going to be that great, right? Most of these proactive medications, right? I've talked about, you know, I made a post about BPC-157, which I'm taking for my Achilles tendonitis, which is the peptide that is like the Wolverine peptide. And so supposedly it helps your healing. I'm not sure that I necessarily, I actually talked to someone within the network about that. And I was like, so can I still play pickleball and heal? And he's like, well, in theory, no, right? Like you want to allow the medication to kind of get into effect. So I don't know that I'm going to go no pickleball, but I'm going to go a lot less pickleball because I am in some leagues that I'm paying for. So I'm going to play in those leagues. But that's the kind of thing that honestly, your primary care physician, one, you're not going to have like that level of conversations with them. There is a certain amount of knowledge that we just have overall, but you know, when we're talking about proactive medications like hormone replacement and things of that nature, most of this is not covered by insurance. When it is covered by insurance, it's usually super chronic situations, and then you have to go into the doctor to have it administered, or, you know, it's something like, well, like even like pellets through like a functional medicine person, you know, it's not necessarily the best way to do it. You know, whenever you start talking about this stuff, There's always going to be compromises that some people are willing to make. You know, I know for myself, I can afford a level of care that's a little bit higher than some people, right? And so I'm going to take, you know, there was a discussion about testosterone, and one woman mentioned that she takes it through her fat. And I said, yeah, you can do that, but it's not as effective as through muscle. And she's like, what? You know, why did my doctor tell me this? I was like, well, you probably told your doctor that, will it hurt? You know, and then the doctor's like, well, it will hurt if you put it in your muscle, which is probably the most effective way. But if you put it in your fat, which is also kind of effective, you know, it'll hurt less. Okay, give me the hurt less, right? And then, you know, is it helping? Probably, right? If you're at zero, you know, which a lot of women are close to zero, it probably does help, you know, but it's not going to help as much, you know, virtually. I take a few injections right now. Almost all of them are subcutaneous through the fat. And I mean, those are a breeze, man. I love those. Every single, you know, you can't even feel it. You know, my testosterone, I dread taking that because, you know, I shoot it into my deltoid. And so it hurts, you know? And so sometimes, you know, the discussions that you're having related to these kinds of medications and things of this nature, your primary care physician is going to go, yeah, no, they'll give you all manner of statins. They'll give you all manner of reactive type of medications once you have a problem. But when you are trying to be proactive, honestly, I think more doctors would be supportive of it if insurance covered it. The fact that insurance covered, most people are making their health decisions. I mean, I have a crazy story. Maybe I can tell it at the end of the podcast, but they're making their health decisions based on, you know, what they can afford and what insurance is going to cover. Well, insurance might cover a medication from 10 years ago that's nowhere near as effective as something now, right? And so these pharmaceutical companies, it costs them lots of money to bring these, you know, medications to the market. So early on, especially if there's high demand, you know, there's going to be a lot of profit in it. So insurance often doesn't cover obesity medication. You often have to come out of pocket, things of that nature. So your primary care physician isn't always going to be super supportive of this type of stuff. And, you know, if you're pre-diabetic, they might have an issue with it. There's just a lot of things that come on where, you know, from my perspective, after, you know, having, you know, this battle with my doctors, and I think Becky's had battles with her doctors. There's a number of people that have battles with their doctors over it. You just want to have control over your health. And frankly, you know, it's just easier if you can come out of pocket. If you can't, you know, well, then do what you can, right? But I just don't know that, you know, a lot of people are going to walk away from those experiences with their primary care physician that are positive, right? Now, functional medicine is a little bit different, but functional medicine is a little bit different because the profit is based on what those people are selling, right? So you have to sort of keep those things in mind. Like, what is the incentive of this person? I mean, do I really want my chiropractor to be filling this role for me, or can I deal with, you know, Ethiform Health, which has a partnership that works with, you know, people that are just genuinely focused on what longevity of life would look like for you. So kind of keep that in mind, because those are things that I think that a lot of people don't know as they walk into these situations. I mean, I can't tell you how many, you know, I was having a discussion the other day, you know, and the guy, you know, ended up getting my phone number, which, you know, is sort of funny because I think a lot of people would want to have my phone number. But I felt like I had to give this guy my phone number because, you know, he's just lost, And he was never going to Becky's laughing. And Becky's probably wishing I didn't have her phone number. But he's just lost. And he's like, man, I wish I knew somebody that knew all this stuff. And I was like, well, you know, here's my phone number, you know, and hopefully, you know, he'll end up joining Eatform and Eatform Health and kind of getting in the right direction. But I didn't feel like he actually, we did find out, this was actually a cool end of the story. As we were leaving, and we were at a pretty nice restaurant, he paid for our meal for my wife and I. And we were just having a conversation with the guy at the bar, which was like really nice and sort of unexpected. So once again, Lifetime coming. It's just going to be a short little blast. We just, you know, we're really a big believer in that Eatform Health needs to be viewed as a longer term thing, right? As most of you know that are members, you know, the memberships are very short in nature. We believe that that's the best way to do that as a company, because it just keeps us, we just have to provide you the best service, right? And I think that a lot of these other companies that sell like 6 month memberships and stuff like that, they do that for them and not for the client per se, right? And the difference is going to be if we ever do offer it, which I'm still conflicted about, that will be the only instance where there would be a contract. But I think most of you that, you know, are looking at what the contract option would be, you'd be much better off signing up as a lifetime client. It's just going to save you so much money over time. And the money that you would have paid over the 6 months would go a long way to paying your lifetime subscription in the first place. So kind of keep that in mind as you're making that decision. Once again, if you have any questions, just throw those down in chat. But we do have some questions that were asked, and we're going to run through those right now. So Becky, take it away.
I actually have one from Terry that she sent me privately, and I was going to let you take that one. Okay. Can you speak to the no pain, no gain mantra I've always heard? Before coming to ETP, I always hurt when I sporadically worked out and was chronically under eating for decades. But 7 weeks into ETP, getting my calories up from 900 to about 1600, carbs from 20 to 109, I'm feeling great with my workouts. And I'm increasing weight almost every exercise every week. So is no pain, no gain a myth? And I shouldn't hurt if I'm fueling my body properly?
So I'm of two minds with this, because I think that there's, yes, it is a myth, right? Because what I think trainers are trying to do in those moments is they're trying to show you a path that you haven't seen, right? So if you don't, you know, if you don't know what it's like to work out hard, you don't know what it's like to transform yourself. You know, before I started CrossFit, I was working with a trainer. Now, I had already lost, you know, the day that I walked into the CrossFit gym, I actually have a picture of it. And I think I was 158 pounds, but I was, you know, skinny fat. If you've seen the three shot, I think I joined July 28th, and then that three shot was on July 4th. So like that middle picture where I look lean, but I'm still like 21% body fat because I don't have any muscle, right? And so. If you want to really build muscle, so there's some people like listening, like if you were on the lifer call, as an example, you know, 109 is like just dipping your toe in, right? In terms of carbohydrates, 1600 is really, you know, and you have to be there, right? Because you started at this other place, and Yeah, but what I think you're probably already seeing, and you kind of mentioned it, is that when you're working out with no energy, the best you're working out is at like 40%, right? So having energy, you know, now I still think you're probably only working out at 60%, right? And then, you know, let's say that we could get calories a little bit higher, carbs a little bit higher, might be able to get you to about 70%. But where the no pain, no gain part comes is like pushing your limits to a level that you never even could have considered before. You know, so I was looking through some pictures the other day, and there was a picture of me from the Tough Mudder, and I had mud all over my face. It actually used to be the profile picture for Eat to Perform. But literally just my face caked in mud, blue eyes. I remember that Tough Mudder because ironically, the guy that is doing the semaglutide is the guy that I ran the Tough Mudder with. Right. And so, the Tough Mudder was sort of my like line in the sand of, okay, once I do this, I'm fit. I don't need to keep playing this crazy fitness game, right? You know, cause I'm, you know, previous to that, you know, I'm CrossFitting three times a day and all these types of things that just weren't going to be sustainable for life. Right. And so I do this Tough Mudder. The goal was to run the whole way and then do every obstacle. The only obstacles I didn't do were the electrical ones, right? The idea of shocking myself while wet just seemed ignorant. And so I remember as I was like walking around one of them, you know, some guy, you know, he's like, don't be a, you know, a female body part. And I was just like, I'm here. I've got mud all over my face. I've just run 13 miles. And like, this is a guy on the sidelines talking trash to me because they don't want to get electrocuted, right? It's just a really funny moment. But I think that I think that when we're talking about optimal fitness and things of this nature, I think like we're having two really different discussions. You're not having a discussion about optimal fitness eating 1600 calories, right? Like no CrossFit Games athlete is eating 1600 calories, right? But if you're a CrossFit Games athlete, there's going to be some pain to gain. Right. And I would say to make major change, you know, I mean, I didn't have any muscle at all in this one picture that I just talked about. And then literally, you know, 5 years later, you know, I have 20, 30 pounds more muscle. Right. I mean, like I didn't have a back. Right. And then, you know, there's this picture, I've struggled to find it, but, you know, where I just have like this V in my back, you know, I mean, I just didn't have a back. I didn't have back muscle. And now I did, right? There was a lot of pain and gain. There was a lot of pushing. Some of it was not that great. You know, once again, I was having kind of a discussion with a friend of mine about that time. And I didn't know what it was like to get hurt. Since then, I've gotten hurt. You know, so I've had to take a smarter approach. But I was not concerned about pain. And partly the reason why I wasn't concerned about pain was because I knew I was on the right path. But it was sort of like many of you when you first start dieting and you know, you're eating like a moron and it's pizza and Mountain Dew, right? And then all of a sudden you clean things up and you're like, oh my goodness, you know, this is a miracle. This has changed my life. It's like, well, okay, no, you didn't like reinvent dieting, right? You just started mixing in chicken and kale, right? And that's good. That's probably positive for your health profile, but it's not going to be like the end all be all thing. And it's not going to ultimately get you optimal body composition, right? There's layers to this, and you sort of have to learn these lessons as you go. But one of the lessons that you do learn is that you will be sore. You will hurt. You will get injured, right? I'm currently working through an elbow injury and Achilles tendonitis. That's what happens to active people. Now, could I be smarter? 100%, right? But there's a lot of people that are really smart, right? And they're using all that smartness to not work hard, you know? And so that's where the no pain, no gain comes from, right? Is it's gonna hurt a little bit, right? But you know what really hurts? You know, like I'm going through this a little bit with my dad right now, who's kind of struggling with his health, right? And he didn't take the approach that I have with Eat and Form. He didn't start getting fit at 39. He stayed the same as he is through 72. And now he's paying the price and it hurts, right? You know what else hurts? Achilles tendonitis, right? Tennis elbow, you know, the soreness that you get from deadlifting 400 pounds. But you know, if you knew it was going to hurt either way, which one do you choose, right? Well, the vast majority of people choose this, right? They choose what my dad chose, right? The people that are saying no pain, no gain, it's a filter for you. They're asking you, do you want to be part of their tribe? Do you want to be part of the tribe that's okay with occasionally dealing with, you know, maybe not injuries, but soreness, things of that nature, right? So I'm not a big fan of no pain, no gain, but I don't distance myself from it either. It's like watching David Goggins videos. I don't know if you guys watch David Goggins videos. I have a really big problem with the overall message of David Goggins, but I also eat it up, right? Because once you become part of this tribe where you're fitness for life, you're going to eat smarter, be smarter, try and live to 100, just your whole outlook changes. And in that change, there's going to be some hurt. And let me go further. When you start to do, so you've been dieting so long and so aggressively that you don't even know what it's like to really feel the suffering related to fat loss, right? There's a certain amount of uncomfortable that needs to happen to lose weight, right? So if you know, getting you to the gym at 5 a.m. or getting you to do meal prep, you know, the lizard part of your brain responds to no pain, no gain, then maybe that's a positive. But overall, it's a myth, right? You don't need to. I mean, the one thing that I see all the time is people talk about consistency. I think everyone's doing consistency wrong, right? People think consistency is Paul wakes up at 5:34 a.m. Paul puts on his slippers. Paul goes down and drinks a shake. That is not what consistency is. Consistency is doing the majority of the right thing most of the time. And when you look at what overall consistently looks like, especially when you're not dieting most of the time. I mean, I was watching this one thing from Mark Wahlberg one time, and it walked through his day. Well, Mark Wahlberg makes $20 million a film. He has 6 different companies that he works with, right, that he's put his own money in. He has to have his day go like that, right? Otherwise, he can't be effective. But he also rebels against that, right? If you don't know anything about his story, there's various documentaries and stuff like this. And he's always changing these routines all the time because the reality is he's sort of a prisoner to these routines. If that was the only way everyone had to succeed, almost no one would succeed. And I would think that I actually think this is why most people fail. And I actually put out an article or a post that I wrote. It actually just went live. That's actually why most people fail, right? Is because they turn, you know, these things into mountains that really don't need to be mountains, right? I mean, I think that if you're 350 pounds to get to 250, you know, there's probably a certain amount of no pain, no gain that you do need to kind of buy into, right? Like, you know, I'm just being honest with you about that. I was 265 pounds. I went to 150. You know, if I didn't embrace no pain, no gain, you know, the guys that I used to lift with, they were like, one of the best things about you is that you've never been injured. You've never pushed your body to these limits. So you're fresh. You know, you're like a 20-year-old, you know, and it was true. I made progress. So, you know, I mean, I went from literally never lifting a weight at all to deadlifting 15 pounds. And then 1 year from that, I deadlifted 500 pounds from zero to 500, right? I literally picked up 500 pounds off of the ground, right? There has to be some pain doing that, right? There was some ignorance too, right? And I've learned a lot in that process, and I try to bring that to you guys, but I wouldn't say it's a myth, but I also would say that once you get past the hard part, and for some people, the hard part is doing what you're doing right now and just getting calories back to normal, right? That's the hard part. Once you get past that, then just the overall habits and routines, you know, you'll still always have the bullshit in your head. I still have it, right? Where there's things, you know, I look in the mirror and go, oh gosh, you know, why can't I look like I did in this picture, the other, you know, we compare ourselves to our best picture, you know, over the last 16 years, you know, and in reality, we have 250. And there was a post by Sarah. We're never going to get through any of these questions if all of these go this long. But it's bringing up so many things, because Sarah was talking about the fact that, you know, perfection is part of the problem for a lot of people. And that's so true, right? And we often use perfection as a way to kind of not move things in a positive direction. But, you know, at 54 years old, you know, like I have a little loose skin right here and stuff, you know, I'm just going to allow myself to age, because that's the way that life is lived best for me. And I would encourage all of you to embrace your age. You know, when COVID happened, my wife was like, I'm just going to let my hair go gray. You know, my wife, I, you know, say I don't notice the difference would be wrong, but my wife was beautiful then, is beautiful now, right? I think that we spend more time in our heads about this shit than other people do, right? And if there's any one wish that I have for everybody within Equal Form, is just to allow yourself to age like you're supposed to. Okay, Becky, I'll try to move faster on the next one.
Okay, this one seems to be a really hot topic and everybody's very interested. How likely is it for postmenopausal women to increase muscle mass? I want for you to address postmenopausal women that are on HRT and those that are not on HRT. And how often do they need to work out?
So if you're not on HRT, basically the best you're doing is staying even, right? And that's not, I'm not saying that from a negative standpoint or you can't fight against nature or stuff like this. I mean, but just the reality is that you have virtually no testosterone. So, you know, and oh, by the way, once again, that discussion that I just had about aging, that applies to menopause. You can, it's perfectly fine to have that decision where you're not, you know, going to build muscle. But, you know, if you can, I would suggest that, you know, some level of hormone replacement could be helpful. So probably the more interesting question is the second part where you're taking HRT, specifically testosterone. In this instance, often they will prescribe some other stuff with it. I'm not, you know, super knowledgeable in that regard, so I'm not going to run through what the little bit of that I do know, because I don't want to say the wrong thing, and then, you know, people then bring that to their doctor, and then, you know, I know that women's hormone replacement is much more involved than men's, right? So you got to kind of keep that in mind. That said, can you build muscle? Yes, you can. It's not going to be a lot, but it's probably going to be enough where you're not losing muscle as you go, right? And so all training cycles, you know, kind of involve these ramp ups where you're doing progressive overload, there's some kind of deload, you might actually move on to something else and then come back to, you know, another way of progressive overload. So like one time, you know, like a common thing for me would be a bodybuilding cycle and then a powerlifting cycle. So in a bodybuilding cycle, I'll build muscle because I'm on testosterone, and as long as I'm eating enough, that is one thing that, so everyone's really interested in the hormone replacement part, but what they're not really interested in is the eating more part, right? And if you take hormones and you are just in fat loss all the time, you might as well not take them. It might provide you some relief, but there's going to be nowhere near as effective as if you were fed. Like the whole point of, and you can run, you know, this is the one you can run by every doctor, right? But now, you know, am I talking about, like I said, pizza and Mountain Dew? No, I'm talking about eating an adequate amount of calories that supports your activity, right? Which is a lot higher than just 1400 at maintenance. Usually it's going to be much closer to 2000. If you're on HRT, this doesn't mean that you never do fat loss, but if you're on some level of hormone replacement, it behooves you to be on a diet, right? Or to start dieting, right?
And he means not just testosterone, but other hormone replacement also.
100%, because all the reason why you're deficient is partially because you're aging, but part of the reason has something to do with chronic dieting, right? So chronic dieters often are hormone deficient because they aren't feeding their bodies enough of what they need. So like as an example, you keeping carbs low is going to keep insulin low, and so therefore that's going to make it very difficult to build and hold on to muscle and hold on to tendons and hold on to ligaments, because those are going to degrade without insulin. Without fat, right? So let's say you choose low fat. Without fat, now your hormones thrive when fat is readily available, right? The reason why people choose low carb or low fat is because you have to choose one if you're going to always be on a diet. Well, guess what? You shouldn't always be on a diet, right? And so once you know that, all the big ideas start to come in place. Like, I can't tell you how many people every single day, you know, come in and say, I'm so confused. And I'm like, it's simple, right? You will understand much more when you're not dieting most of the time and you're only dieting occasionally, right? And because when in those non-dieting periods, you actually have a chance to build muscle. If you're on hormones, sure, you can build muscle. Is that the end game though? I would say the end game is more about keeping what you have and building enough so that when you move to, like, let's say you build some in a bodybuilding cycle, and you move to a powerlifting cycle so that you can get heavy, so you can lift heavier, so that when you move to bodybuilding, you know, it's more and more effective. In the powerlifting cycle, you will likely not build muscle, right? Because, you know, what allows you to build muscle, and this goes a little bit to the no pain, no gain. You really want to go to failure sometimes, right? You know, especially for upper body. For lower body, you want to go to fatigue. This is why virtually everyone with thighs loves leg extensions, right? It's the one exercise you can do to failure to your lower body without, you know, 500 pounds on your back, right? And so when you can do to failure or fatigue, you're breaking down enough muscle. And then when you're taking the hormones, you're going to be able to rebuild that muscle stronger. But you won't rebuild that muscle stronger unless you're doing higher sets and reps, right? And the case for lower sets and reps is so that when you move to higher sets and reps, you're actually lifting more. And so the stimulus so that you can build muscle will happen. So that's a great question. I would say the great majority of women that are on HRT now, and why am I saying women? Am I just picking on women? No, because women have this belief that it's their hormones that are stopping their weight loss. That's not it. The hormones is stopping them holding on to their muscle. And so therefore they are building, storing fat as a result of that, right? So if they can keep their muscle, they won't store fat, right? They could potentially build some muscle, but more importantly is that once you build your calories up, people don't want to believe it's this simple, but it is, right? Once you build your calories up, now you can get to a deficit. You can't get to a deficit when you're eating 1200 calories and you just eat to 1100, right? It's so close that your body barely notices the difference. If you're eating 2400, and through, you know, a gradual cut, you end up at 1200, your body notices that and you lose weight as a result of that. But that doesn't mean that the performance cycles aren't important, because that's where you're holding onto that muscle, potentially building more. But yeah, postmenopause, no. I mean, you know, let's just be real here. Without replacing the hormones that are gone, you're going to age, and age does involve some level of muscle attrition.
Okay, and last question here. Are there vitamins and supplements we should be taking? And specifically regarding BCAAs, who should take them and what point should someone start taking them? Sorry, BCAAs and creatine.
Yeah, so are we checking chat here also?
Yes.
Okay. Because I see 7 and I don't know what that is. BCAAs, you're better off taking whey protein. The reason why people take BCAAs is because they view it. So BCAAs, similar to collagen, right? Where people think, you know, oh, it's like free protein. It's like, no, it's an incomplete protein. It's not doing what you think it's going to do. Can you use it for the benefit of your skin and bones and things of that nature? Absolutely. But it works better when you have an adequate amount of protein. If you're using it as protein, stop doing that. That's ineffective. You're way better off using whey protein, and that is allowing you. But if you're eating 60 grams of complete proteins and 60 grams of incomplete proteins to get to 120, you're actually getting to about 80, right? So you have to get to 120 with complete proteins and then allow for enough of the BCAAs and collagen to get you to say 150. Okay, so we've addressed that. Vitamins, should you take a multivitamin? I don't. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't. The multivitamin thing, I'm just going to be completely honest with you. I have a bias with it. Because the great majority of people that are suggesting that you take a multivitamin are also the people suggesting that you should eat 1,100 calories to lose weight. If you're eating an adequate amount of calories, you're probably getting enough vitamins, right? So should you take it in a deficit? Probably, you know. Once again, I don't. But the reason why I don't is because the diet cycles that we have here at Eat to Perform are short, right? So if we're talking about 6 to 8 weeks, you know, that's really not going to be that big of a difference. And so you can get away with not doing it. You know, the one thing I will say, if you do take vitamins, and I'm not anti-vitamin, like if you want to take vitamins, go right ahead. I mean, it's probably addressing some deficiencies. It probably is working in your favor. What bothers me is that when I go to Target and I see Goli, you know, or Goji or whatever it is, what am I saying it wrong, Becky? The apple vinegar. But that company didn't exist, and it now exists based on a lie, right? That you know, if you take apple vinegar gummies, you're gonna lose weight. And now it's a company, and I'm just like, as a person trying to tell the truth and build a small business and support all of you with great information, man, it just gets really frustrating when you see these people succeeding, right? With a lie. I mean, the amount of vitamins being sold compared to the amount of vitamins needed, you know, probably not commensurate, right? It's just one, vitamins do tend to land in, and I'm not anti-vitamin, right? If you want to take your vitamins, one of the best advice I can give you is to take it with food, right? Because, you know, the way that, you know, mixed meals work, your body's going to absorb the vitamins typically better. There's some that don't work that way. You do your research. But in general, vitamins are kind of overrated if you're eating enough calories most of the time, right? Because you are going to get a good nutrient profile, especially if you're doing something like Eat to Perform, where we're kind of looking at, you know, how much sodium you're taking in, or what is the variance, you know, where we're teaching you to eat mostly nutrient dense with some energy dense options, right? If you want to take vitamins, you certainly can. I would say that if you're going to leave Eat to Perform and just go back to dieting all the time and being scared of food, yeah, take some vitamins, right? Because you're not helping yourself, right, by any stretch of the imagination. And I do get it, right? Like in a lot of ways, like Eat to Perform is sort of like AA, you know. The minute you walk into an AA meeting and you've overconsumed alcohol and you've had life problems as it relates to it, you literally can never live life without knowing that happened, right? And Eat to Perform is like that. Once you hear that you can't just diet your way to optimal body composition, it just rings true, right? We all kind of know this is true, but we also know that, hey, this actually doesn't sound easy. This sounds like there's some trial and error to it. There's some understanding, which is, by the way, why you need coaches, right? There, you know, if I could get away with doing Eat to Perform without coaches, I 100% would. It would be a much easier business, right? But people, there's just so much mental stuff that people have to work through that the coaches really are just invaluable to all of you. And I'm sure all of you, even in the earlier stages, know this, right? Especially early on, right? So coaches, as an example, most people don't realize this, is that they do the majority of their work in the first month, right? Once your lifetime, you're a breeze to work with, because you've gone through every single possible scenario, right? The coaches that take you on in the first month, they are really doing hero's work. And because many of you are coming to us with a lot of questions, it's very frustrating. It's all confusing, right? There's so much information out there. I mean, we know we're not the only place you're getting information from, you know? And so, I think that, remind me I got thrown off for a second. Remind me of the question, Becky.
At what point they should start taking creatine, for instance?
Oh, creatine you want to take yesterday, right?
Yes.
There's no reason not to take it. In fact, I need to take it. I got my creatine put in a box when I went to California, and I haven't taken it in a couple months, and I need to take it. If you don't take creatine, you know, literally, I people think of it from the standpoint of water retention, but what they don't realize is that if the real goal is fat loss, you have to have more available energy and you have to have full muscles. That's what creatine does, right? So creatine, definitely you would take. BCAA is kind of overrated. If you want to take it, go ahead and take it. Do you take creatine every day? Yes, I do. Just take 5, you know, milligrams or whatever. I actually take it right before I brush my teeth at night. There's some people that will say that, you know, the effects can be a little negative if you drink it with your coffee. I would argue that if it's a better routine for you to drink it with your coffee, drink it with your coffee, you know, but I take it before bed. Not for any particular reason. If I was to take it most optimally, it would probably be in a protein shake post-workout. But the amount of advantage for that is not high, right? So, I would suggest to all of you, similar to what I would suggest for your workouts, right? Is it more optimal to work out in the morning or more optimal to work out in the evening? There's science that argues both ways, but the reality is what is going to allow you to work out more, right? What is going to allow consistency? And remember, consistency is not rigidity. The minute you make it into rigidity, I think a lot of people that say I struggle with consistency, what they really struggle with is rigidity and their rejection of rigidity. And if you're making consistency rigid, you're doing it wrong, right? So hopefully that's helpful. We did have one come in late. I think it was just the creatine question. So I appreciate everybody being here, and we'll talk to all of you later. Bye now.